Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Kwok Ting Test when we come back. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. We're taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if your plumber said, "He who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client"? Or what if a carpenter said that? "He who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client." Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or steps is incompetent? Well, you know, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself in court has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or that carpenter. Now, listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor of law, a law school professor at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he had to say. He said, "It is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed." He said it's worse than that. "Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court." Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and for their clients, that it is a cruel hoax. Now, that's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Now, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package while you're at it. It's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure, our school is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org. Or call us direct at 417-273-4967. The Kwok Ting Test. It's an obscure case called Kwok Ting versus United States. It was decided in May of 1891. It serves a very valuable purpose that no one knows about, especially lay people. You're not supposed to know this. It's the test whereby we determine whether someone is telling the truth or not. The police know it. Criminologists know it. Most lawyers, all judges, most prosecutors are fully aware of the Kwok Ting test. But the reason that it's not disseminated to the public at large is because if you knew the answers to the test, then you would be playing on a level playing field when you're being interrogated by the police or being interrogated by an attorney when you're giving a deposition or filling out an interrogatory. And, of course, you're not supposed to play this game on a level playing field. I'm supposed to have all of the advantages over you, and if, perchance, you are telling the truth as a matter of fact, well, then you can get away. In other words, you can get off the hook. You might not go to prison if you are actually telling the truth. Now, the bald fact of the matter is that if you tell the truth, you're more likely to go to prison. Let me repeat that. If you're being interrogated by the police, and you walk in and you actually tell them the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, off the top of your head, as best you can remember it, you are more likely to go to prison than if you shut up. And it's because of the Kwok Ting test. And we're going to apply this test to you, whether you know it or not. And when it's all said and done, if you cooperate with the police, you may not go to prison, you may not go to jail. But if you're the target of the investigation, you most likely will. Now, if you're just an average Joe Sixpack, and you don't know the Kwok Ting test, never heard the story before, let me introduce you to Kwok Ting versus United States. A Chinese person, 16 years of age, claimed the right to enter the United States because he was born here and hence a citizen. He and his father testified that he was born on a certain street and then went to China with his mother when he was 10 years old. But he remembered no circumstance of his early life, and he knew nothing of the English language. His father, who worked on a sewing machine, produced a so-called store book showing the purchase of a ticket for the boy and his mother, but he gave no particulars of his life in San Francisco or of his being known among his neighbors as having any children. Now, the boy remembered nothing but the names of three men who, he said, accompanied him to China. But he testified that his mother had frequently repeated to him and then held that the evidence was not sufficient to establish his citizenship. On appeal from the Circuit Court of the United States for the Northern District of California, the petitioner, who is also the appellant, is a member of the Chinese race, but claims to have been born within the United States and consequently to be a citizen thereof. He is 16 years of age, and he arrived at the port of San Francisco in the steamship City of New York in February of 1888. The officers of customs refused to allow him to land, holding that he was a subject of the Emperor of China, and within the restrictions of the Act of May 6, 1882, and the Supplementary Act of 1884, he was accordingly detained by the captain of the steamship on board, and he applied through a friend to the Circuit Court of the United States for the Northern District of California for a writ of habeas corpus to obtain his discharge from such detention. And he alleged that he was not within the restrictions of the Acts of Congress, but that he was a citizen of the United States, having been born therein. The writ was issued, and the petitioner brought before the court, and when his testimony and that of his father was taken in support of his pretension, he testified as to his birth as counsel. As counsel observed with surprising particularity, his story was that he was 16 years old, that he was born in San Francisco on DuPont Street upstairs, and retained in that city until he was 10 years of age, upon which he went to China with his mother. And he also mentioned the names of three persons on the ship whom he knew. And when asked how he remembered their names, he answered, "When I got to China, my mother told me very often of those people and their names. She repeated them to me, and I remembered them." When he was reminded that was 6 years before, he responded, "My mother sometimes speaks those names to me very frequently." His mother was in China, and he knew nothing of the three men named. Although in the city, according to his statement, for 10 years, he did not, upon cross-examination, show any knowledge of any places or streets therein, or of the English language. The following is a specimen of his testimony. Question: "Can you count in English?" Answer: "I do not understand English." "Can you count in English?" Answer: "I can count in Chinese, but not in English." "Do you know the names of the days of the week in English?" "I am too small. I did not learn it." Question: "Did you know anything at all in English?" Answer: "No, sir, not a word." Nor did he mention any circumstance, incident, or occurrence except being born in DuPont Street upstairs, which would lead one to suppose that he had ever been in the city. Now, his only memory seemed to be of the names of the three men who accompanied him back to China, whom he had not seen since and whose names he only knew from having heard his mother repeat them. His father, who was examined, stated that he worked on a sewing machine, that the petitioner was his boy, and that he was born at 1030 DuPont Street upstairs and went to China with his mother and one of the witness's friends, and that he wanted his boy to come back to learn English. He also produced what he called his store book, in which he had entered the purchase of a ticket for the boy and his mother. He gave no particulars of his residence in San Francisco, of his having a family there, or of his being known among his neighbors or others as having any children. The court, after hearing these witnesses, held that the petitioner was not illegally restrained of his liberty, but that he was a Chinese person forbidden by law to land within the United States and had no right to be or remain therein. It accordingly discharged the writ and ordered that the petitioner be remanded to the marshal to be returned to the captain of the steamship. From this judgment, an appeal is taken to this court. Now, Mr. Justice Field, after stating the facts as above, delivered the opinion of the court. And he said, "The question presented is whether the evidence before this court or the court below was sufficient to show that the petitioner was a citizen of the United States. The testimony given by himself amounted to very little. Indeed, it was of no force or weight whatever. The particularity and positiveness with which he stated the place of his birth in San Francisco was evidently the result of instruction for his examination on this proceeding and not a statement of what he had learned from his parents in years past. And his failure to mention any particulars as to the city of San Francisco, which he certainly ought to have been able to do if he resided there during the first 10 years of his life, was surprising. A boy of any intelligence arriving at that age would remember, even after the lapse of 6 years, some words of the language of the country, some names of streets or places, or some circumstances that would satisfy one that he had been in the city before. But there was nothing whatsoever of this kind shown, and he gave the name of no person that he had ever seen. He described no locality or incident relating to his life in the city, nor did he repeat a single word of the language, which he must have heard during the greater part of several years, if he was there. The testimony of his father was also devoid of any incident or circumstance corroborative of his statement. The production of the so-called store book, in which there was an entry of passage money paid for the boy and his mother, does not strike us at all conclusive. The accounts of a mere worker on a sewing machine would not be likely to occupy much space, and the alleged entry could as easily have been made as the manufacturer of the story repeated. If he could not believe the story in the absence of the book, we should hesitate to yield credence to it upon the exhibition of the entry. If the petitioner was really born in the United States and had lived there during the first 10 years of his life, the fact must have been known to some of the father's neighbors, and incidents could readily have been given which would have placed the statement of it beyond all question. It is incredible that a father would allow the exclusion of his son from the country where he lived, when proof of his son's birth and residence there for years could have been easily shown if such in truth had been the fact. Undoubtedly, as a general rule, positive testimony as to a particular fact, uncontradicted by anyone, should control the decision of the court. But that rule admits of many exceptions. Now, there may be such an inherent improbability in the statements of a witness as to induce the court or jury to disregard his evidence, even in the absence of any direct conflicting testimony. He may be contradicted by the facts he states as completely as by direct adverse testimony, and there may be so many omissions in his account of a particular transaction or of his own conduct as to discredit his whole story. His manner, too, of testifying may give rise to doubts of his sincerity and create the impression that he is giving a wrong coloring of material facts. All of these things may properly be considered in determining the weight which should be given to his statements, although there be no adverse verbal testimony adduced. In Kavanaugh v. Wilson, where the action was by a real estate broker against the personal representatives of a deceased customer to recover an alleged agreed compensation for effecting a sale, and the only witness as to the contract was the son of the plaintiff, whose own compensation depended upon the plaintiff's success, and the compensation alleged to have been agreed upon was more than double the usual compensation, it was held that the statement of the witness under those circumstances was not so entirely free from improbability as to justify a direction of the court to the jury to find a verdict for the plaintiff, although there was no direct contradictory testimony presented. The court said, "It is undoubtedly a general rule that when a disinterested witness who is in no way discredited testifies to a fact within his own knowledge, which is not of itself improbable or in conflict with other evidence, the witness is to be believed, and the fact is to be taken as legally established so that it cannot be disregarded by court or jury. But this case is not fairly brought within this rule. Here, the witness was not wholly disinterested. He was a son of the plaintiff engaged in his business and thus biased and interested in feeling. His compensation for drawing the contracts and how large that was to be does not appear. Depended, I infer, from the evidence upon his father's success in getting his compensation as the broker." So the court then went on to observe that the story told by the witness was not entirely free from some improbability, and that it did not appear why the broker was promised more than double the usual price for the sale of country property, nor why the compensation was never spoken of before or after in the numerous conversations heard by witnesses, nor what could have included or induced the promise of the large sum when the usual commission would seem to have been ample compensation for any service to be rendered, nor why the party made the unusual promise to pay the absolute sum in no way dependent upon the amount for which the property might be negotiated. Now, these circumstances, the court thought, presented a sufficient case for the consideration of the jury, and it held that the court below erred in refusing to submit it to them. In Kohler v. Adler, it was held that a court or jury was not bound to adopt the statements of a witness simply for the reason that no other witness had denied them, and that the character of the witness was not impeached, and that the witness might be contradicted by circumstances as well as by statements of others contrary to his own, or there might be such a degree of improbability in his statements as to deprive them of credit, however positively made. In the case of Elwood v. Telegraph Company, it was cited in support of this position, where, in delivering the opinion of the court, the rule and its exceptions were stated by Judge Rapallo with great clearness and precision. So also was the case of Kavanaugh v. Wilson, also above referred to. Now, in Waite v. McNeil, the Supreme Court of Massachusetts held that a verdict was not to be set aside, although it was given against the positive testimony of a witness, not impeached, where there were circumstances in evidence tending to lessen the probability that such testimony was true. Numerous other cases might be cited in support of the same general doctrine. For the considerations mentioned, and the fact that the court below had the witnesses before it, and could thus better judge of the credibility to which they were entitled, we're not prepared to hold that its finding was not justified. Its judgment is therefore affirmed. Now, the reason that I bring this to your attention is because oftentimes we listen to somebody's story, or somebody tells us a story, and we don't know who to believe. So the courts have developed a test to make a determination as to whether or not the story or whether or not the testimony that's been advanced is credible. And there are three rules that we follow. Rule number one is that the testimony must be complete. Two, the testimony must contain extemporaneous detail. Three, the testimony must be supported by witnesses and or evidence. So I'm going to tell you a story. A real story, a true story that occurred in what we call parole evidence. Now listen to the story, and let's see whether or not we can determine the truth of the matter. I was traveling with another man named Earl Sherman on Highway 17 south from Berkeley to Oakland. In the vicinity of Emeryville, in the high-speed lane, the traffic ahead of us stopped suddenly. Mr. Sherman, who was the driver of the car, slammed on the brakes. I, riding in the passenger seat in the front, looking out the front window, believed that we were going to strike the car directly in front of us. I braced myself, put my hands on the dashboard, and with my eyes fixed on the lit taillights of the car ahead, we stopped just inches from striking the car in front of us, whereupon immediately we were struck in the rear. I looked and said to Mr. Sherman, "It's the Delta truck behind us." Traffic ahead of us began to move again. We had been traveling at about 40 miles an hour in the high-speed lane. The hour was around 4:15 in the afternoon. Rush hour was rapidly approaching. The Delta truck then moved to the immediate right lane and passed us and went on down the road as if not much of any consequence had occurred. Mr. Sherman gave chase, and at the Alameda Tube off-ramp, he motioned the driver of the Delta truck to exit, which he did. And there on the street level, in the vicinity of the furniture company, began to ask the driver why he hadn't stopped earlier to exchange information concerning the accident, whereupon the Delta truck driver said there wasn't any reason to because he didn't strike our car. Now, the damage to the right rear quarter panel of the 1956 Cadillac Eldorado was extensive. Later, it was about $600 worth of damage, which was very substantial concerning the quarter panel of the automobile back in 1956. Now, as it turns out, the Delta driver said he did not strike our car in light of the fact that there are two eyewitnesses in the car. Mr. Sherman, who looked in the rearview mirror and said, "I see him," and the passenger, that's myself, who, upon impact, immediately looked through the rear window and saw the Delta truck there. So here are two witnesses, eyewitnesses, right at the scene, who observed the accident, felt the impact, were affected by it. Both are prepared to testify in court that the Delta driver struck our car. After all, we were there. The Delta driver maintained his innocence and he said, "I didn't strike your car. It wasn't me." Now, let's suppose that you were sitting on the jury and you had heard this story from my lips on the witness stand, having been sworn, and the Delta driver comes in and he says, I didn't hit their car. Who would you believe? The two witnesses in the car? Or the Delta driver, who, singly and by himself, said, "I didn't do it"? Now, there's a way for us to prove whether or not the Delta truck struck the automobile. Now, let's suppose on cross-examination that the Delta driver simply asked these questions without any external evidence, such as paint samples or any potential other evidence from other witnesses who might have seen this transaction, or if maybe there was damage done to the Delta truck or photographs and external evidence brought in. If only we heard the parole testimony. Listen to the Delta driver, who, acting pro se, might ask a series of questions of the witnesses along these lines. "Mr. Gordon," he might say, "you have testified that you were traveling southbound on the Nimitz Freeway, Highway 17, in the vicinity of Emeryville. Is that correct?" And I would answer, "Yes." "And you further testified that you were traveling in the high-speed lane, that is, the lane closest to the center divider, and that you were traveling at approximately 40 miles an hour. Is that correct?" "Yes, that's true." "And is it also your testimony that the traffic in front of you stopped abruptly and that you expected that there was going to be a collision between your car and the car ahead?" "Yes, yes, I expected a collision." "And while Mr. Sherman slammed on the brakes, did you feel or experience a rapid deceleration of the vehicle in which you were traveling?" "Yes, yes, I did." "And as your car was decelerating rapidly, were you preparing for a potential collision by bracing your feet and putting your hands on the dashboard?" "Yes, yes, I was." "And were you looking out the windshield?" "Yes, yes, I was." "And did you keep your eyes affixed to the car directly in front of you?" "Yes, yes, I did." "And did you strike the car in front of you?" "No, no, we didn't." "And I believe, Mr. Gordon, that you testified that immediately after you had stopped, you felt the collision of the Delta truck striking your automobile. Is that correct?" "Yes." "And did you tell Mr. Sherman, 'It's the Delta truck'?" "Yes, I did." "And did he respond, 'But I see it through the rear view mirror'?" "Yes, yes, he did." Now, Mr. Gordon, let me ask you this. After your car stopped, you testified that immediately thereafter the Delta truck struck your automobile. But think about it for a moment now, and could it have been 1 second from the time that you stopped until you felt the impact of the Delta truck? And upon reflection, I might have answered, yes, it possibly could have been 1 second. Now, Mr. Gordon, think about this again. Could it have been 2 seconds before you felt the impact? And upon reflection, I could have responded, yes, yes, it possibly could have been 2 seconds. All right, Mr. Gordon, now think about this for a moment, and let me ask you this. Could it have been 3 seconds? And upon reflection, my memory, thinking back to the accident, I would have answered, no. No, it wasn't 3 seconds, but it could have been 1 or 2 seconds, but not 3 or 4 or more. Now, Mr. Gordon, you testified that it was immediate, But upon reflection, your recollection having now been refreshed, you tell us that it could have been 1 second or it could have been 2 seconds. Now, Mr. Gordon, I believe you testified that you were looking through the windshield. Is that correct? Yes. And I believe you testified that you were an eyewitness. Isn't that true? It is. Now, Mr. Gordon, do you have eyes in the back of your head? No. No, I don't. Well, Mr. Gordon, if your eyes were affixed to the automobile directly ahead of you through the windshield, and you did not see the Delta truck until you turned around and looked through the rear window, then, Mr. Gordon, isn't it a fact that you are not an eyewitness to the accident itself, but rather you are a witness at the scene of the accident? And there, boys and girls, is the first chink in the story. The first chink in the story is that I personally am not an eyewitness to the transaction itself. It's very true that I was there, but it is not true that I saw the Delta truck strike the automobile. Furthermore, Mr. Sherman, who saw the Delta truck directly behind our truck, behind our car, did not see the Delta truck strike our car. Remember, his attention was directly on the car in front of us. He did not look in the rearview mirror until after he felt the impact. Neither one of us were eyewitnesses to the transaction, although we would have both testified that we were eyewitnesses, and we would have certainly testified that the Delta truck struck our automobile. Now, as a matter of fact, the Delta truck did not strike our automobile. Now, if that's true, then why would we come into court and testify that it did? And we'll talk about that when we come back right after this. Now, you are listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. Now, if you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour website is updated every week. It has a radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend will necessarily reciprocate, and that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the Kwok Ting Test. You probably never heard that name or that term before. But the United States Supreme Court came up with that test by delineating from the Kwok Ting case a three-part test in which they will use that to determine whether or not somebody's telling the truth. And they cited a number of other cases from a number of other courts as to the technique or the test and the modality for administering that test to make a determination as to whether or not you're telling the truth. Now, before we go into the details of how this occurred, I should tell you another story. The story of Professor Swift, who back in 1918 came up with a startling piece of information. And the startling piece of information deals with witnesses who testify on the witness stand and whether or not those witnesses are telling the truth when they testify. And he found out that the witnesses aren't telling the truth when they testify. In fact, a witness, when he's on the witness stand and he's testifying, is actually lying 25% of the time. 25% of the time, a witness will be lying, even though he may believe that he's actually telling the truth. So, in Professor Swift's experience back in 1918, he did a test in which he did a test in his classroom, and the way he did this was by throwing a torpedo on the ground. So the gist of the story goes like this. He had contacted four students and he had put a story together. And four of these students that he had previously coached banged on the door of a class. He was having a class. There were 29 students in the class. And while he was conducting the class here, these students burst into the room. And so the story goes like this. An altercation was heard in the corridor, and when the door burst open, four students, two young men and two young women, dashed into the room. Miss R, immediately after entering the room, dropped a brown paper package on the floor. This package contained a brick so that the occurrence might not be too inconspicuous. K flourished a large yellow banana as though it were a pistol, and all struggled across the room to the side opposite the door where Professor Swift himself was seated among several members of his class. Professor Swift stood up at once, protesting at the interruption, and as he arose, he threw a small torpedo on the floor. Upon hearing the explosion, X fell back, crying, "I am shot!" And he was caught by Miss R. All then hurried out through the open door. Miss T, picking up the brown paper package, which had been dropped near the door by Miss R. Now, this entire scene occupied less than 30 seconds, and it was startling to the class. All of the members of the class jumped up and crowded back against the wall, believing that it was a real riot. The 29 students of the class were then told that the scene had been made to order, and they were asked to write out in detail their memory and observation of what they had seen. Three of the actors were actual members of the class, and Miss R, although not a member of the class, was a senior who was prominent in college activities. All of the class knew her, and of the 29 witnesses to this transaction, only three could remember that four persons had entered the room. And although no disguises were used, not a single person was able to recognize all four of the actors. Many of the students described the occurrence as that of a mob or of a crowd. Seven students recognized three of the actors. 11 students recognized two of the actors. Seven students recognized one of the actors. And four students could recognize none of the actors. And yet all of these actors were persons that they met every day. Now, surprising as these figures may seem to those who think that even under excitement they could recognize an acquaintance whom they had seen at least three times a week for 8 months, the results of this experiment are nevertheless too favorable to observation and memory for recognition by elimination of those present played an important role. Now, eight of the witnesses saw persons who not only took no part in the performance, but they were not even present. Now, of these eight, one saw a former member of the class who had withdrawn about 3 months earlier, and a young woman who had never been in the class and was not present was seen by two witnesses. The descriptions of the clothing were so general as to be worthless for purposes of identification, and if details were given, they were generally found to be inaccurate. Only one witness spoke of the brown paper parcel. No one saw Miss T pick it up. Now, several students saw the flash of a pistol. And one young woman wrote that they were attempting to hold back a man with long black hair. This evidently referred to H, since the other young man, R, had light hair and followed H into the room. H's hair, however, was short, and the description was that of a young Italian who had been a member of the class earlier in the year, but who had withdrawn from the class several months before this experiment. Later, this student, in her deposition, actually named that Italian as being among the participants. Five of the reports did not contain a single item of truth or fact. Three witnesses saw nothing except a confusion and a mob bursting into the room. Six other witnesses were unable to testify to more than the identity of one of the participants. To these, all else was blank. Now, Professor Swift draws this conclusion from his experiment. Identification is always fundamental in criminal cases, and positive recognition by well-intended, uninterested persons is commonly accepted unless the alibi is convincing. In our drama, in our experiment, the observers were all well acquainted with the participants, and yet they were surprisingly incompetent as witnesses. Their minds were prepared, had the event involved a real crime, to recognize one witness whom there might appear to be corroborative evidence. The witnesses proved to have had little very definite knowledge of what actually happened, and had a crime actually been committed, their testimony should have had very slight value. And yet, it would have been accepted because they were, after all, eyewitnesses. Now, only a few identified actors, and in several instances, these identifications were so uncertain as to be readily transferred to someone else under the influence of suggestion. In estimating the accuracy of memory, Professor Swift gives some very illuminating additional experiments that he made with his classes, showing through how many mouths a story must pass before it loses its identity altogether. Now, that's quite an experiment. That occurred back in 1918 at Washington University. Since then, there have been many experiments in psychology classes by many different professors, and many books have been written on the subject. In fact, 30% of all rape convictions are bogus. We now know that because we have DNA testing, and we can now go back and we can test through DNA and come to the conclusion that, wait a minute, this man who is in prison and maybe been there for 20 years is not the rapist. So why is it then that rape victims will come into court, point their finger at a defendant and say, that's the man that raped me, if in fact it didn't happen? Notice the term suggestion. Let me tell you a little story here again. One time I was in the Webster County Jail, and they were attempting to take my fingerprints, and I had told them about six deputies and Sheriff Bill John. I said, now, Mr. John, you need to get a court order to take my fingerprints, and that's because of Rule 30B2. And Sheriff John, not being experienced in civil rights or criminal law, decided that his policy superseded the Supreme Court's Rule 30B2 and proceeded to take my fingerprints against my will and over my objection. In the process of doing this, I was knocked to the floor and the deputies were twisting my arm behind my back, whereupon I cried out in anguish, no, no, don't beat me anymore. Now, Sheriff Bill John was wearing cowboy boots that day, and while I was on the floor, Sheriff John had put his foot with his cowboy boot on my head, and he was applying pressure to my head onto the floor by standing on my head. Now, this isn't called torture here in the United States. This is called pain compliance. Just in case you had never heard that term before, it's called pain compliance. We don't torture prisoners here in the United States. So, as Mr. John was applying pressure to my head, other deputies were twisting my arm behind my back. Now, when you twist your arm behind your back, it hurts. There's pain there. Now, the objective here of the deputies is to apply enough pain that I would open my hand and comply with the fingerprinting process. Now, while this commotion was going on, and while all of this yelling was going on, no, no, don't beat me anymore, my wife and two totally disinterested witnesses, both court reporters, happened to be outside the door. They were attracted by the commotion and the noise and the yelling going on inside. Now, they could not see inside, even though there was a window in the door, because there was a Venetian blind on the inside of the door, which was closed. They could clearly hear what was going on in the booking room from the hall, but they could not see inside. But during the commotion, one of the deputies had hit the door, hit the Venetian blind, and one side of the Venetian blind had come unhinged, and it fell down, thus exposing through the glass the events that were transpiring inside the booking room. And the three witnesses, that is my wife, and the two court clerks, could clearly then see that I was on the floor, that Sheriff Bill John had his boot on my head, and that the deputies were twisting my arm behind my back, and that I was crying out in pain. No, crying out in excruciating pain. Let me write this down, Bill John. And my wife then said these words. Listen carefully now. My wife said, "Oh my God, look at the blood." Seven words. Oh my God, look at the blood. Now, that's called the power of suggestion. I'm here to tell you that there wasn't any blood. I wish there had been blood. I would have desired that there be blood. I would have liked to have had blood on my shirt and blood on Bill John's boot for forensic evidence as I came back later and sued him under the Civil Rights Act. But unfortunately, there wasn't any. Now, I had a fellow one time. He was the sheriff's administrative assistant. His name was Larry Richards, and Larry said these words. He said, "Don't make any marks on him." That was in a prior case in Boise, Idaho. And boys and girls, I want to tell you right now that that was about the worst that I hurt for approximately a week or 10 days in my life. But there weren't any marks on me. There were no bruises, contusions. There were no cuts or abrasions. There was no blood, but there was god-awful pain. All right. Now, the police of America are very skilled at this, just as interrogators are very skilled in interrogation. Pain compliance is a common use of force against prisoners to extract confessions. Goes on all the time. In fact, our Supreme Court commented on that in Miranda versus Arizona back in 1964 when this subject matter, or 68, I forgot now which is 68, I guess it was, when the subject matter of Miranda warnings and the right to counsel present before statements are made, and of compelled testimony or compelled confessions comes up. Now, in this particular instance, Professor Swift, going back now to the Swift case, notice somebody flourished a banana. Professor Swift is the person who threw the torpedo, which is a 4th of July device that has a cap in it, and when you throw it, it acts like a bomb, and it hits this button on the face of it, and it explodes. And you can smell the cordite. You can smell the gunpowder. And these students smelled the gunpowder. They believed that this person had actually been shot. One student later in the report here says that it was a .32 caliber Smith & Wesson revolver. Why would this guy testify that it was a Smith & Wesson? Did he see the gun? Did he see Smith & Wesson engraved on the gun? Why couldn't it have been a Colt .32? Why did it have to be a .32? Why couldn't it have been a .38? And why couldn't it have been some other brand? Did he actually see that it was a Smith & Wesson revolver? Why couldn't it have been an automatic? You see, people testify to what they believe they saw. These two women standing there, these two court reporters with my wife, both came into court and testified that they saw blood everywhere. Boys and girls, I testified that there wasn't any blood. I was the victim. I was there. I wish there had been blood. I appreciated their testimony. Those two women will go to their graves believing that there was blood everywhere. And the reason they believe there was blood everywhere is because the scene that they had observed was shocking to them. They had never seen somebody being beaten up before. They did not know that sheriff's deputies beat up on prisoners. They had never heard of such a thing. And when they saw it, they heard this quiet suggestion. It was, "Oh my God, look at the blood." And so in their minds, in their shock at what they were viewing through the window, they believed from their memory that there was blood everywhere. After all, there should have been blood with all of the commotion that they were viewing, the shocking circumstances of the sheriff standing on a victim's head, of deputies twisting his arm behind his back, of the victim crying out in agony and pain. There should have been blood. There wasn't. Why then would they testify that there was blood when they didn't see it? It's because they believe they saw it. It was suggested to them. And that's what happens to a rape victim when they're in police headquarters, when they're at the police station, and the police suggest that this is the rapist. We'll cover that next time in greater detail. But for your information, at this moment in time, the Professor Swift test has been repeated hundreds, thousands of times since 1918. It's well known in psychiatric and psychology circles, this phenomenon. And yet it's used by the police. It's used by prosecutors. You just saw it at Duke University. 5 rugby players prosecuted for rape. The prosecutor and the police all know that these five young college students were not the rapists, that there had been no rape. They had the exculpatory evidence. They knew that. And yet they proceeded with the prosecution. But why? Why do we have 30% of our prison population? Well, 30% of the prison population that is convicted on rape charges. Bogus. Why do we have 1 prisoner out of every 3 accused of rape who is actually innocent serving time in our penitentiaries, for which, by the way, you and I are paying $35,000 a year, and the real party, the real guilty party, and I'm not suggesting that these women aren't actually raped. They probably are. But they were not raped by that guy. Now, that's pretty shocking. Now, that may happen to you. Someday, somebody may point their finger at you, just like the case with Earl Sherman and the story of the Cadillac automobile, in which I would have testified that I was an eyewitness. Now, tomorrow when we come back, we'll take a look at the Earl Sherman case in a little clearer detail, and I'll explain that to you in greater detail. And we'll look at the Swift and the rape and the Bill John story. And we'll analyze it and find out why this phenomenon takes place so that we can better understand how to defend against it. I mean, after all, it may happen to you someday. Hey, I'm about out of time. I'm going to have to wrap it up right here and remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Okay, our time's up. We got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.